Welcome to 1869, the Cornell University Press Podcast. I'm Jonathan Hall. In this episode, we brought together two Cornell University Press authors in the hopes they would have a lively discussion, and they certainly delivered. One was Christopher Ewing, author of the new book, The Color of Desire, The Queer Politics of Race in the Federal Republic of Germany after 1970. And the other was Jake Newsom, author of Pink Triangle Legacies, Coming Out in the Shadow of the Holocaust. Christopher Ewing is assistant professor at Purdue University. His research focuses on the intersections of queer history and the history of race in modern Germany. He has previously published in Journal of the History of Sexuality, Sexualities, Bulletin of the German Historical Institute, and Sexuality and Culture. Jake Newsom is an award-winning scholar of German and American LGBTQ plus history, whose research and resources educate global audiences. He is the founder and director of the Pink Triangle Legacies Project, a grassroots initiative that honors the memory of the Nazis' queer victims and carries on their legacy by fighting homophobia and transphobia today through education, empowerment, and advocacy. You can find him online at wjakenewsom.com. We hope you enjoy their conversation. Hello, Christopher and Jake. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having us, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to have you both together. I know you'll have a lot to talk about. Christopher, your book has just come out, The Color of Desire, The Queer Politics of Race in the Federal Republic of Germany after 1970. And Jake, you published with us a couple years ago in September, your book came out, Pink Triangle Legacies, Coming Out in the Shadow of the Holocaust. If you guys were, I mean, obviously you're meeting right now online, but let's just imagine we're at a cafe, we're sitting down, we're getting a cup of coffee or tea. What questions do you have for each other?
Yeah, well, first I'd love to hear from Chris. You know, this is, you know, his book is just out, and it's a project that I've been following with great interest, and I'm so excited to now finally see it reach the shelves.
Great. Thanks, Jake. Yes, it's exciting. It's also relieving to kind of be finished with the project and see it out in the world. But yes, no, I'm really excited to be finished with it and to sort of see the reactions, and also to be talking to you, Jake, because I had the pleasure, I think, of reviewing your book about a year or so ago. And for me, it was such a wonderful model of how to do queer history in a way that's widely accessible and is written in a way that many people can access from the important history that you're writing. And I guess, like, I wanted to ask a little bit about that in two ways. One, how do you take histories that are not only deeply complex, but also emotionally fraught, and present them in a way that people feel like they can engage with them and gain something from them? And then also, I think sort of the work that both of us are doing, like, we're connected to these communities in different kinds of ways, as queer people who are writing queer histories, but then also as US Americans who are traveling back and forth between Germany and the United States. So I was also curious to hear your thoughts about how you position yourself as a historian in relation to those whom you study.
Oh yeah, those are great questions. I'll take the first, actually, I guess that makes sense. You know, it was really important for me from the beginning to write a book that, sure, I wanted it to make contributions to scholarship, but I really wanted this to be a book about queer history and about the queer community, but written for the queer community itself. And so I really tried from every draft and the editorial process to avoid, you know, as much of the jargon as possible. I knew that I needed and wanted to engage with the historiography, for example, but also without having a section called historiography. So how were we able to, you know, how could I engage with the scholarship? But I chose to do it in a way of, like, well, in my book, really, which was all about kind of the different manifestations of memory about the Nazis' persecution of queer people, the historiography really was kind of a subject matter in and of itself. So being able to kind of pay tribute to our fellow scholars as participants in this history making, you know, as well, I also had, I guess you would say, like, non-historians read pretty much every word that I wrote. You know, I wanted to make sure, especially passages that I was really trying to grapple with in terms of clarifying, you know, did I explain grafted memories clearly enough, for example, you know, having someone completely outside of the field, outside of the discipline altogether, read and offer feedback on clarity was really important to me. It often meant that I had to, I guess, sometimes make decisions that like, oh, well, I guess I would have never framed it that way, or I might not have articulated it that way. But if that's how readers are would take it, then that's, you know, was really important for me. And so in terms of positionality, I think that that's also related to why I chose to write in the style that I did as well. Was, you know, when I first started, this book kind of grew out of my dissertation. And so when I was a PhD student, still had a lot of imposter syndrome, right? But had this idea of historians need to be completely objective and removed from what they're writing about. And so, you know, I would reach out to, for example, gay activists from the 70s in Germany and just try to remain very removed and kind of scientific about the whole thing. And I found that like that there was that didn't open a whole lot of doors, because right, it's, you know, here's this random historian in training from America wanting to like come and quote unquote study you and you know, pick apart your memories in your life. And I found that really once I kind of opened up and introduced myself kind of more as, hey, I'm part of the community. Like I'm not just some historian trying to write about the queer community. I'm part of it. This is me wanting to understand my history as well. Then the doors opened, and then the community opened up in a way and put me in contact with people that I would have never found otherwise. And so, you know, I really discovered that leaning in to my connections to the history, leaning into my positionality, actually didn't hinder my research as a historian, but actually improved it, I think. And so that has just been something that I always felt then increasingly indebted to the people who shared their memories, shared their stories with me. And so I always wanted to make sure then to write in a way that honored them, but also uplifted, you know, their voices and their contributions to the book as well. Yeah, thanks for asking that.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And that's something that I also try to tell my students a little bit. We've actually been talking just this past class about objectivity, sort of thinking about Hannah Arendt and her interrogation of that, and the ways in which we have this myth, right, of the historian as an objective social scientist who can go into these communities, study them as one might imagine a 19th century anthropologist. And that didn't work then and doesn't work now. And I think that one of the great advantages that we do have as queer historians who are doing queer history is feeling through the connections to our community, both in past and present, and developing those emotional relationships with the people that we're talking to, but either formally in oral history interviews or also informally, people who are gathering the sources that we might need to access. Some of the best sources that I have, the best documentations that I have, are from people that I met and I developed relationships with and who weren't associated with formal archives. And certainly there are wonderful formal archives in Germany. The Schulesarchiv, the gay archive, is magnificent. They have such a wonderful repository. And at the same time, they built their repository from people who have relationships with the archivists and with the curators who just donate their stuff and donate sometimes even their apartments. And I think that's sort of one of the great pleasures of doing this kind of history, is being able to not only have access to the material, but develop a sense of their emotional place within our historical subjects' lives and within our friends' lives as well. So I really appreciate you elaborating that, because I feel very similar resonances with the ways that I try to study the past.
And, you know, I think that shines through in your book. So anyone who has not read it yet, absolutely go get it. You know, is the place of like individual stories, their own voices. I loved, you know, especially as you're talking about kind of sex tourism and the travels that people had, and or sometimes when they were frustrated because they couldn't travel to these, you know, quote unquote exotic places. And so I really find myself drawn to these types of histories, especially when they are histories of communities that have been marginalized or silenced for so long. Of course, you know, all of the kind of the theory is really important, but also it's just like it is important to have these individual stories and kind of community centered narratives documented in books like yours. So one of the questions I had, and this is just one that I'm always interested in kind of every single book, what was it that drew the historian, the author to the topic in the first place? You know, I know from my own book, this is not the book that I sat down to write. You know, it was ended up being completely different. So how, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that process of what kind of stuck out to you, what drew you to the topic, and then maybe what were some surprises along the way?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a pretty common experience, right, for historians, or just anybody writing a book, right? It's very hard to write a book quickly, I found. And so this is the result of probably 10 years of work. When did you start to write this project that eventually became Pink Triangle Legacies?
It took about 10 years. You're right. Yep.
Yeah. And so I think that thinking about who I was at the start of the project, I was a 22-year-old straight out of undergrad, and I wanted to write a dissertation on the internationalization of the LGBT rights movement after 1945. And so that's part of the reason why I found your work so interesting, is that you do touch on some of those themes that originally drew me to the field. And I began, actually sort of before where this book begins, in the 1950s and 1960s, looking at magazines like Der Kreis, Die Insel, Der Weg, these magazines that were really important to homophile political movements, sort of these early organizations that take shape in West Germany in the context of deep political repression and try to carve out space to make claims about rights and the possibility even of state protection in the aftermath of National Socialism, a process that you also document, Jake. And what really kind of struck me, in addition to the political claims making, was the proliferation of images of men of color, and men of color in often cast in deeply exoticizing visual terms. So like Black men wearing zebra print or set in the jungle, alongside poetry that talked about the deep eroticism that these men had for white Central Europeans. And that surprised me in a few ways. One, it surprised me that this seemed to be completely compatible with or even supporting a liberal progressive way of doing sexual politics. And Laurie Marhoefer has sort of written a lot about the ways in which this is actually deeply embedded in gay rights from the very beginning. But then also, when we're thinking about the context of the 50s and 60s, nobody was really talking about it. And so it seemed like something, okay, racism seems really important, and sexual racism seems really important to these political movements as they're starting to coalesce after 1945. How do we think about that relationship? And how do we think about that relationship, especially when so many of these stories about like sex tourism, right, which is a category that I use very cautiously since it takes on deep political meanings in the 90s, these stories that are often set in North Africa and depend on the idea that Islam is conducive to same-sex sexual encounters. Like, how, this seems to be completely counterintuitive to the way that European political formations think about Islam right now, in which Islam is supposed to be threatening to sexual minorities and sexual rights and freedoms. And so that was sort of the two driving questions. How do we make sense of racialized desire and politics together? And what does that tell us about this reversal in how Islam is conceived as going from conducive to homoeroticism to threatening same-sex desiring people in Western Europe and across the world? So that's kind of how I came to the project, and I kept digging and digging and realized that, okay, the answer, well, it's not only racism, but it's also anti-racism, that there are queer activists of color who are constantly like pushing back against this. There are white anti-racist activists who are working in organizations like the Deutsche Aidshilfe, but also white lesbians, people like Dagmar Schultz, who are working in line with Black German feminists and queer Black German feminists in order to create new political identities and spaces. So it becomes this entangled mess of racism and anti-racism together. And I found that we can't really pull the two apart, but when we pay attention to the two together, we start to understand, okay, how it became possible to reconceive of Islam within this framework, and also the ways in which these assumptions that we're currently operating with are themselves very unstable.
Wow. Thank you. Thanks for walking us through that, because even just hearing you kind of re-summarize it really kind of drives it home. And I'm glad you mentioned Laurie Marhoefer's work, because as I was reading your book, I just kept, I had just maybe a few weeks ago finished Laurie's, the book on Hirschfeld and like race and gay rights. And so that was kind of already in my head about how racism and queer rights are so often intertwined, especially in Germany. And so I loved your point about how there's nothing inherently, you know, anti-racist about being queer or even queer activism, that as you've just demonstrated throughout your book, that it takes these moments of conscious, not only reflection, but, you know, continuous action of defining who are we talking about, who's in this community, who's in this new, you know, radical movement and who's not. It made me two things, and I hope I can remember both of them. It made me think that when I was in the archives and trying to, you know, trace the post-Holocaust life of the Pink Triangle and its role in activism, you know, it was repurposed and used really in a lot of ways as this, you know, progressive liberation symbol, kind of a rallying cry for not just queer liberation, but really it was kind of enmeshed in a lot of leftist politics. And, you know, I kind of just almost fell victim to like the, oh yeah, it's liberatory for everyone. And so it wasn't until like I followed the path of the Pink Triangle over to the United States, where I think racial politics and racism was much more kind of on the forefront of activist minds more generally, but even in the queer movement. And I started, you know, finding stories of queer activists of color talking about the Pink Triangle, what it meant to them or what it didn't mean to them, that I kind of stopped and was like, I've got to go back to this, to the German context, because, you know, I see all of this kind of very explicit discussion of race and the Pink Triangle in the US context. I don't think I saw that back in the German context. And so it became apparent to me that while this symbol in a lot of ways was a symbol of liberation, what is just as important or striking is who's not included in that. And there just was this kind of huge absence of this discussion of race and queerness when it came to, for example, the connection to National Socialist history. And so, you know, I really just find your book as like a perfect kind of puzzle piece or like companion to a lot of the work that I did, because it's actually putting that gap or that like that lack of context like is now being filled in by your work. And I just keep reading your book, like going back from pages to pages, being like, yes, this is exactly what I, you know, I was trying to say that, but I didn't know how to say it. And so it just, I'm excited that both of our works are through Cornell and relatively close together. And I hope that folks kind of use them as companion pieces.
I hope so too, because your book was absolutely a reference point as I was writing my own and thinking through the contested politics of memory, which are so important to queer politics across the board in post-war West Germany and post-war Federal Republic, because precisely as you document, memory becomes an important site where identity is negotiated, where all of these different kinds of political claims making happen. And so it was really useful for me to think about that and think about the use of symbols. And one thing that I thought that you did really beautifully with your book was also think about the use of literature and stage as a site where the politics of memory really come forward, because that was a challenge for me. And I think this also just has to do a little bit with my own scholarly background, in which I can do really well with political documentation, activist texts. Those make sense to me. But literature doesn't in the same way. And stage doesn't in the same way, not in a historical frame. I enjoy both those things. I love both those things. But trying to put those together and into conversation with the political history I was writing was a challenge. And so thinking through what you do with your book and how you think through stage and literature, that was really helpful for me in developing frameworks that I needed to position these different works in their political context. So yeah, I think that these two are companion pieces in so many different ways. They even look aesthetically a little bit similar, which I really enjoy. But yes, no, I think that that's entirely right. And I was also curious too, if we're thinking about the politics of memory, because these are so fraught, Where do you see sort of those tensions lie? Because one of the insights, sort of again from Laurie Marhoefer, but we also get this from Tiffany Florville as well, in terms of who gets to be incorporated into sort of a queer identity framework and who doesn't, and who gets to be incorporated into the narrative of queer political history and who doesn't. How do you see the politics of analogy working here as queer activists are starting to develop new frames for talking about themselves, talking about the memory of persecution, when they're, of course, one of many groups that are subject to Nazi violence in specific and also generalizable ways? How do you see analogy working in this? And was that also a challenge to kind of work through as we think through sort of inclusions and exclusions as they operate within queer scenes, as you're trying to tell a story? And I think tell a story that really does need to be told about the place of queer people in the history of Nazi persecution and its aftermath.
Yeah, that I'm really glad you asked, because that was a really difficult theme and topic for me to navigate. And I feel like it's actually one of the themes that I've grappled with all the way through the 10 years of researching and writing, is how, you know, in the 70s, queer activists, beginning in Germany, but then especially once this history kind of jumped the Atlantic and made its way into the US context, begin in their process of crafting a history, but great, because this history had not been written by professional historians. There weren't books about it. There weren't studies about it. So these activists, and even actually to your previous point, through kind of stage plays, through literature, and even then through political flyers or, you know, chants and marches in the street, begin piecing together their own history, because there is this lack of history with a capital H. And so they're trying to figure out how they as a community can look back to this history of the Holocaust and understand what happened to people like them under the Nazi regime. And part of what comes out of that, I think some of it is accidental and some of it is quite intentional, are these inflated numbers of, you know, that the Nazis really tried to murder every single LGBTQ person in occupied Europe, that they were successful in murdering. I've seen numbers of up to 2 million gay people murdered. And once the academic history, the kind of the academic history field, began actually confronting and studying this history, and primarily led by queer people themselves, those numbers of victims actually were like revised. And we now know that somewhere between like 10 and 15,000 gay men were sent to concentration camps. And so quite a lot lower than, you know, estimates of 2 million. And I think that at first there was like a lot of blowback on, you know, the activists for intentionally inflating these numbers for political gain or, you know, political expediency. And, you know, at first I kind of found myself as an author in that camp of like, well, let's go back and correct all of these past activists for giving the wrong numbers, or for a lot of times they classified what happened, the Nazis' policies against queer people, as genocide. Whereas now the historical research suggests that it actually wasn't, like, there was no plan for mass genocide, that these policies, yes, they were deadly, but they weren't genocidal in the way that the Nazis' policies against Jews or against the Roma and Sinti were. So, as I said, at first I felt kind of this knee-jerk reaction almost to say, nope, they were all wrong, and this is the real history, this is the truth. And it then occurred to me, right, that these activists, these playwrights, these queer community members are trying to piece together a past at a time when the historical profession has remained intentionally quiet about this. And so there is a lack of access to information that is evidence-based or archival-based, rather. And so in a way, can a community be blamed for getting things wrong when the arbiters of the past, professional historians, have refused to provide evidence or to put it into the quote-unquote, you know, archive? And so really what I've tried to then do is actually just show that historians are just one player in the politics of memory. They are just one voice in collective meaning making about the past. And so while they are one source, and they're clearly their sources, you know, that you and I put trust in, that communities piece together their understanding of the past using multiple sources, including novels, including plays, including movies. And so I've tried to kind of step back in terms of my authorship as like judgment of what's right or wrong, but actually show this is what's happening. And these are how people are trying to make sense, not only of themselves, but of their place in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, I really loved your insight that you provided in the book as to the role of the historian in conversation with all of these other actors who participate in the creation of history, right? It's not just the professional historian who does that. And I think that's really important to bear in mind, both to kind of get us out of our own sort of hubristic ways, but then also to think too about, okay, what maybe even the historical profession is, or just what doing history is. It is a constant process of revision, right? We are in conversation with each other, just as we're in conversation with the communities of which mm-hmm. we are a part. We are in conversation with our historical subjects, and we're engaged in a process of revision such that we can explain change over time and do it in a way that is also empathetic to our historical subjects. And I think for me, that was very important and a very important part in writing this history, because I do try to take a very critical approach to what I see as being the harms of racism and racist thinking within queer politics. And I think that's an important story to tell, but it can only be told also in thinking about, okay, in what context are these people working? And more importantly, what does that also mean for queer people of color, as they're simultaneously engaged in a queer political movement as diverse and fractured as that might be? And what is that going to mean too in our understanding of queer politics as we try to integrate queer people of color into sort of these whitewashed narratives? There are historians that I draw on and thinkers that I draw on who are working, like you said, in the United States. There's sort of this very explicit conversation that's been going on for a long time in the United States, and much of that conversation has been largely ignored in some circles of German history writing, even as it's been happening in Germany as well. And so thinking about, okay, what does that actually mean? Because there is a way of writing queer history that says, well, queer people of color were there too. And that doesn't actually do a whole lot of work. What that does, that can bolster success stories and say that, okay, great, queer people of color were there too. We don't really have to think about it anymore. It's like, no, actually, when we do pay attention to what does that mean and what racial exclusions were persistent and meaningful for queer political movements, and what ways did queer people of color push back against those, and what ways did some queer people of color also invest in those as well, then the story becomes a lot messier, but I think also a lot more, maybe accurate is the wrong word, because I didn't want to buy into a narrative of, okay, historical truth, there's just one. But it becomes, I think, more attentive to the complexities of people in the past, which is a much more, I think, humanistic way of writing history. And that's something that I also really enjoyed about your book as well, is the actor-centered approach that you take and attendance to the ways in which people are messy. There's no story of heroes and villains in the past. There's just a story of people who, for the most part, are trying their best, and in so doing, cause each other harm, and in so doing, create inspiring stories. And it's our job to kind of think about, what does that mean for historical change? And how do we do that in a way that, you know, pays attention to people as people?
I've been a fly on the wall here, but I've enjoyed listening to both of you. It's been amazing. Both of you spent over a decade working on these two books, and it clearly shows you are a wealth of knowledge. And it's just so great to hear about this history that it was hidden, and you had to unveil it and reveal it. And there's a constant exploration even now. And so that's why I wanted to bring up the present. Where you're well-versed in the history now, and there's always more to explore. But as you know, in January, there were some historic protests in Germany against the far right. And one of the slogans I saw was, never again is right now. Mm-hmm. And on top of it, we're now at the 30th anniversary of the abolishment of paragraph 175, which was the law that regulated and criminalized sex between men. So just throwing it out to both of you, and maybe this could be a long answer in and of itself, but where do you see Germany in 2024? Can there be a slide backwards? Can there be a repeat of the past? Or what are your thoughts of what's going on in Germany in the next 10 years, let's put it that way, or 5 years? That's maybe pretty tough.
Well, I think it's a great question. I think that the answer could be applied, of course, to Germany, but also to the United States, because I think that one of the lessons of the Pink Triangle that has resonated with me more so now, even after publication, is about how progress and LGBTQ visibility is always fragile, right? We saw the end of the Weimar Republic, the ushering in of the right-wing fascist dictatorship, and the reemergence of homophobic rhetoric and violence happening at such a staggering pace in the transition from late 1920s to early 1930s, that I think that to me is a profound message for today, because we are witnessing in a lot of ways, you kind of ask, can we go backwards? In a lot of way, at least in the United States, we are moving backwards in terms of LGBTQ rights already. You know, since 2016, but especially in the past few years, I think it's like 2021 set the record for the most anti-LGBTQ laws on the books in the United States, which was broken by 2022, and then again by 2023, and already again by 2024. And so we are finding ourselves in this kind of backwards progression. And I think that this history, both mine and the one that Chris writes about, can show us how just because some progress has been made for a particular subset of a group that's been marginalized, right? And Chris writes so powerfully about homonationalism, this idea that as long as the state kind of views you as respectable, that you're allowed into the benefits of citizenship, but then those that are considered outside that bounds of respectability are going to be further marginalized. And I think we've grown a little bit, I don't know if complacent, it might be a strong word, we've grown accustomed to, right, we've won marriage equality, right? Like things are good, things are great, but we're also seeing now the really coordinated attack on LGBTQ rights. And so I think what we can take away from these histories are a reminder and warning of how far homophobia, transphobia has gone in the past. And that's really a call for us to decide how far we are willing to let it go today.
Yeah, I think that's entirely right. And that's something that we see. And it's a very distressing feature of both German and US political landscapes right now, is the slow rollback of LGBTQ rights gains, often first targeting trans people and doing so in ways that draw on the language and very longstanding historical language of trans people as constituting, and queer people more broadly as constituting, a threat to the family and a threat to kids, right? And this has been sort of like targeting some like most marginalized people in our community already. And that's been sort of a test balloon, I think, to sort of a broader rollback of sexual rights and freedoms. And that was something that kind of drove this project, not from the beginning, actually like from the middle, right? So if I began this project in 2012, that was a very different moment from right now. But after my dissertation defense in 2018, I was having drinks with my advisor and my partner and the committee. And my partner, he turns to my dissertation advisor and he's like, Dagmar, what happened to homonationalism? Because this is 2018, this is the middle of the Trump presidency. And that's actually what I titled the epilogue, What Happened to Homonationalism? Because in 2015, when marriage equality is instituted at the federal level in the United States, that seemed to many people to be the triumph of a broad LGBTQ rights movement dating back to Stonewall, to 1969, and moving ever closer to full equality as realized through the institution of full marriage equality. And then a lot of those assumptions get rolled back very, very quickly, both in the United States, where the following year Trump gets elected, and that really does sort of institute a lot of these sexual politics that we're seeing now. And then also in Germany, where marriage equality is instituted in 2017, 3 months later, if I'm doing the math right, that's May 2017. Then in September of 2017, the Alternative for Germany party, which is a radical right-wing party, gets elected to the Bundestag, and they're the first party to the right of the Christian Democrats, the ruling Christian Democrats, to be elected to the Bundestag since 1961. And people are shocked, right? People are absolutely shocked that this could possibly happen. They're also shocked that one of the lead candidates is a lesbian, which is sort of a fun, a terrifying and curious pairing. However, people are shocked that, okay, this could happen. And I think this is sort of part of the history that I'm trying to bring forward as well, is that despite this broad surprise, there have been people who have been telling us about German nationalism for a very long time, right? So reflecting on the months around 1990 and 1989 with the collapse of the Berlin Wall, Mayim, who's one of the leading voices of the Black German Women's Movement, she says, no, this Germany, this are the we that Chancellor Kohl is talking about, does not include all of us. And Black people at that moment, Jews, Roma, Sinti, people of color, were experiencing violence at this moment of national euphoria. And so a lot of this history that I'm working with has already been told. The history of racism is something that people have been talking about, but are consistently marginalized and ignored from these grand narratives of German progress, often refracted through the lens of the apparent progress of sexual rights and freedom. So just as we're seeing this terrifying rollback of sexual rights and freedoms in the past 5, 6, 7 years, these are also part of longer historical trends and are closely linked to those historical trends that have to do with both sex and race. And so for me, the story that I'm trying to tell is both the institution of homonationalism and also its simultaneous unmaking from the 1970s on. The history of homonationalism is always a story of its unmaking.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for this illuminating conversation and your insights, taking your history, bringing it to the modern day. And I like that you both were saying, hey, this should be a companion set. we agree. Anyone that's listening to this, we encourage you to buy both Chris's new book, The Color of Desire, and Jake's book, Pink Triangle Legacies. That would be a great set and it would be great reading. So we really appreciate you both coming on, and thank you so much for this great conversation.
Thanks for having us, Jonathan.
Thanks, Jonathan.
All right, take care.
That was Christopher Ewing and Jake Newsom. Christopher Ewing is author of the new book, The Color of Desire, The Queer Politics of Race in the Federal Republic of Germany after 1970. Jake Newsom is author of Pink Triangle Legacies, Coming Out in the Shadow of the Holocaust. If you'd like to read both of their books, use the promo code 09POD to save 30% on our website at cornellpress.cornell.edu. If you live in the UK, you can save 30% by using the discount code CSANNOUNCE and visit the website combinedacademic.co.uk. Thank you for listening to 1869, the Cornell University Press Podcast.